Welcome everybody to this edition of the Irish People podcast. This episode is going to be focusing in on energy policy, in particular in relating to climate change. My name is Ailish Ryan. I'm hosting today's podcast and I'm a member of the Workers' Party Ard Comhairle and previously worked as a city councillor on Dublin City Council. Today we're going to be joined by four guests: Lorna Bogue, who is a Cork City Councillor for the Green Left Party; Hannah Daly, who is the Professor in Sustainable Energy in UCC; Garrett Green, who's Assistant Professor in Statistics in UCD and also a member of the Workers' Party Ard Comhairle and a public representative in the in Dublin Central for the Workers' Party; and Adrian Kane, who is SIP2 Divisional Organisation Divisional Organiser, apologies, with responsibility for energy, aviation, transport and construction.
Actually, sorry, I should have said this at the beginning. I was too busy looking at my phone and looking up facts and figures. But we have had an AGM at the end of last year. So we have actually changed our name to Rorta, the Party for Workers and Carers.
Okay.
Because we were going out with the door with Rorta Glas, Green Left, and people were seeing the word green. And it was deeply toxic. People were very, very unhappy to see that word. You know, I suppose for obvious ecological
reasons. Yeah, that's sad.
But yeah,
so it's kind of cares. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, I suppose that's kind of the job of socialists really at the moment, is to save the green movement from itself to an extent. Okay, so that's great, Lorna. So the Party for Care for Workers and Carers, Rorta, the Party for Workers and Carers. Yeah. So we might start with that report from the EPA, Ireland Climate Change Assessment. Hannah, if you wanted to give us maybe just an overview of what you think were the most critical issues emerging from that report, that might open up the discussion.
Thanks, Ailish. Yeah, I was really happy to be involved in that. It was a mammoth undertaking of about 23 academics and researchers across Ireland and coordinated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And I suppose what that was a bit of a like a downscaling the global assessment of climate change that we're familiar with from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, to Ireland. So to assessing what is the state of knowledge around how is the climate changing in Ireland, how that's impacting people, how we can adapt to its effects, and how we can cut greenhouse gas emissions. And I suppose I won't speak for most of those topics because I'm not like a climate scientist. My speciality is in the energy system and the energy transition and kind of energy and climate policy. But just to summarize that those kind of findings is that, you know, as we really know that climate change footprint is already in Ireland, that it's already affecting us, our climate has changed. And it's really posing a profound risk to us, to, you know, to farming, to infrastructure, you know, and extreme heat and sea level rise, of course. So we're really kind of coming out of that this era of this stable climate, and it's because of human caused greenhouse gas emissions. But I was part of this kind of this new volume doesn't really have a precedent in these assessment reports. And this volume four was called Realizing the Benefits of Transition and Transformation. And what this is all about is that, you know, there's both profound risks from climate change, but also the kind of the underpinning, the reasons that our energy system, our food system are not sustainable. It also causes many of these other harms across society about inequality, about, you know, environmental damage, ecosystem damage, problems with well-being, and that by kind of taking measures to address both greenhouse gas emissions and these other things all at the same time with this integrated approach that kind of recognizes that the interlinked nature of these challenges, you can actually use how we address climate change to bring about a much better society, you know, fair, more sustainable society where people with greater well-being. So we're talking about realizing these benefits, but to do that you have to take away the barriers, and some of those barriers include, you know, vested interests, you know, politics of it, the I suppose the lack of capital that people have to transform, you know, how the media responds to climate change and so on. So I suppose what the big message from our report is that there's a huge benefits of transformation to deal with climate change, but it's going to be hard work to do that and that it takes a lot of transformation across institutions, people, how we communicate about climate change and so on. But I'd recommend if anyone wants to give a read, the summary for policymakers is you know, it's just a few pages, and the synthesis report, which includes all of that. So it's called Ireland's Climate Change Assessment, ICCA, and it's pretty easy to find online.
Right. I think, Anna, like, I admire your optimism there. I think you've clearly, I suppose, decided to take a positive approach to this, which is probably necessary in a sense in terms of how we talk to people, because I think there's a sense of kind of fatigue maybe around unsolvable issues sometimes. Adrian, you mentioned there that you know my dad, so I hope you won't take offence if I ask you to give us a bit of a historical angle on things. I was wondering, I suppose, you know, I think for somebody of maybe, you know, kind of under kind of 40 or under 30, it's a bit of a revelation to know that a lot of the kinds of, I suppose, the kinds of policies that we're trying to maybe introduce on the left around energy are ones that actually have been there for a very long time, or were there for a very long time. Things around nationalisation of energy, around, I suppose, the treatment of workers in the industry, and around, I suppose, the rights of people to have energy provided at a fair price. I suppose, can you tell us, until, I suppose, the 90s, what was the landscape like in terms of energy provision in Ireland? I suppose the good and the bad.
Yeah, well, I suppose for my own sins, I've spent a lifetime trying to get out of the bog, but never quite successfully. So I started my working life with Bordemona, and come from the Midlands. And I would have actually been involved in the negotiations last year, closing the first bricket or the last bricket factory, which was in Derrynlough in Offaly. And I remember that the first protest that I was ever on was back in the early 90s when we were trying to save Lullymore, which was the first bricket factory that was built and the first one to close. And I think that there was... Lorna had talked about, you know, how even green has become a kind of tarnished word. And I certainly think probably an extension of that is even this kind of concept of just transition, which is, you know, has got quite popular in more recent years. I think that the term itself kind of had potential and had a sense of radicalism to it. But I think that the more popular it has got, if you're to ask fellas who work on Bordemona and the last of the bogmen, as it were, it has got to be quite a tarnished term. And at the same time, what I would say, coming specifically to the question that you're posing, Eilish, is that you go back and you read Todd Andrews, which I did recently, Todd Andrews' biography, you know, Man of No Property, and the sense of zeal in which the kind of people who built the state, and something like Bordemona and building that particular company, which even if you look at the kind of dynamics within the differences between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, there's an interesting comment in saying that Ard na Cruach was always seen as a Fine Gael type policy. Bordemona was more associated with Fianna Fáil, the small man and the small farmer, you know. But there's a dynamism there of kind of a very radical approach to energy creation that manages to establish decent wages and builds houses and transforms, you know, a very poor part of the country to a situation now whereby we're left with a just transition type application that's not really working very well. And you know, the more I look at it, and I may sound like an old Stalinist or something, but you need to get back to a space whereby the state is taking a very active role. You could reindustrialize the Midlands. I mean, Garrett, I think, has written a really interesting policy paper on nuclear. I see, and a lot of us are from Cork on this call, DSB looking at Ahada as a hydrogen plant. I think they're really interesting developments. I think a part of the trade union movement has always been to extend economic sovereignty to the many. And that was done through an energy policy that served us well from the 1920s up until the 1980s, up until the 1990s. That we have lost a lot on that due to its privatization. And I think we need to look at a twin track approach in terms of, I certainly always believe that a collective approach to renewables, particularly with regard to wind energy, would be a lot more attractive in the same way as that we did with water, where you have group schemes. Something like that, I think, would be could be a very dynamic part and maybe quite a unique kind of part of energy policy in this country. But I also think that we need to be looking at this the state as the provider of energy, the distributor of energy, the state being relegated to a regulator role, I'm not sure it really works all that particularly well. So I think they're the kind of, you know, going back to the future, as it were, in yeah. terms of some of the policy that we need to develop again.
That's really interesting. And actually, I'm just looking here at Todd Andrews' Wikipedia entry. It describes him as a Republican and a public servant. And I don't think there's many people today that would feel comfortable with both of those labels. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, that he obviously embraced it. And for anybody who wasn't aware, he was instrumental in setting up the Turf Development Board that went on to become Bord na Mona. So like Adrian there spoke, Lorna, about the dynamism of the state, which, you know, I think today is perhaps not something that we would necessarily associate, or many of us would associate, with Fianna Fáil. But I would tend to agree that at that point there was a sense of vision amongst certain parts of the Irish state, often coming from civil servants as well as the state itself. I wonder, do you see that dynamism in terms of Ireland's approach to particularly, I suppose, renewable energy or energy policy generally today?
No, I have a different view of that. So obviously I sit on Cork City Council, and I'm very often confronted with the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on a, you know, a fairly regular basis. I suppose there was a certain dynamism at the start of the Irish state, but that was a dynamism that was generated through a newly empowered national bourgeoisie that got in charge of the newly formed state. So this was a particular class that had a certain amount of development work to do in order to, you know, open up Ireland for international capital, and move away from that kind of protectionist state that existed, a state that, you know, was generally kind of based around the idea of sovereignty and all of these kind of, you know, insular ideas. But I suppose, you know, like
in terms of today, how would you is that a word? Is that a word you'd use to describe energy policy today?
I think that same class is still in charge of the Irish state. Like we have never had a government that has not been dominated by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, and it seems to me that Sinn Féin is now stepping into that particular kind of you know, national bourgeois type of role, where they're making a very solemn promise to the ruling class and to international capital that they're not going to do anything particularly different. So is that national bourgeoisie dynamic in terms of protecting its own interests? Yes, certainly. And the energy system in Ireland is being utilised in a specific way, which is that we have a transmission system that is falling apart. We have a system that is outdated, is still running on fossil fuels that are just, you know, completely outdated. There's no prospectus for that to change. And where is all of that energy going? Well, it's going towards things like data centres. You know, so like I think the national bourgeoisie is dynamic in a certain self-preserving type of way. But I don't think in terms of energy policy in general that they're willing to put any money into development when it comes to the Irish state at all.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Lorna. Like, I think I would agree with you to the, I think it's a good point that it's self-preserving, but sometimes I suppose, Garrett, I don't know if you feel like, even if we take the case of data centres, it feels like the Irish bourgeoisie is not even very good at protecting itself, that it can tend to make policy decisions that somebody more powerful is telling it to make, but actually end up doing itself a disservice. And I don't know, I wonder, would you describe its approach to energy policy in that way at the moment?
I think that we have this, I think it's both a crisis in confidence of the state itself in its ability to do anything, and it, for that matter, in the, what you could call the capitalist class in Ireland, in its ability to actually plan its way or think its way out of this energy crisis. And it, in large part, it's also due to a lack of actual expertise in knowing how to, expertise that maybe has been lost that we had previously, mm-hmm. in knowing how to actually build energy systems, how to actually plan your way through out of these problems. And that results in things like, as Laura mentioned, with data centers or with private transmission systems, we now have a situation where our energy transmission system is creaking, the generating system is creaking. But there's this sense that the ESB, which might previously have had a great deal of expertise, has lost that through privatization, through being run down over several decades, that there isn't a sense that the competence exists there in the state to actually rebuild these things or to redesign them. And we have this recent situation with regard to data centers, and then the recent private wires proposal, which was an idea that's been floated recently by the government that might allow private developers to start building their own independent parallel energy transmission systems, which is floated in some way as allowing people to build their own independent renewable energy sources. But I think in effect is really an admission on the part of the state that the transmission system is potentially reaching a point of collapse where private energy users, big energy users like data centers, want to have the fallback of being able to build their own system, to be able to essentially disentangle themselves from this mess and build their own. And the state, by facilitating this, is essentially admitting that it doesn't feel it's capable of actually maintaining the grid in its current status. And this, I think, it shows this sort of contradictory policy that we have, which on the one hand, we're driving, have a public policy driven towards reduction in energy use, which is possibly not really very well backed up by the technical or engineering knowledge. Certainly, I think there's a big difference between, if you look at EirGrid, and what they would say about the state of the transmission system and what the Department of Energy would be saying. So maybe there's a policy, a disjuncture there between the policy and the actual engineering side. And then at the same time, you have an admission of this in the fact that when dealing with these private interests, who are very concerned with their access to energy, the state is essentially admitting to them, well, maybe you're going to have to go your own way and secure your own supply. But I think that what this comes back to is that in the last 30 years since, I mean, Norna might say since the beginning of the state, but certainly in the last 30 years, this process of building up the state's capacity to actually provide energy or to provide services to the people has reversed. And in fact, we've had this continual loss of this kind of industrial and technical ability in the state. We have organizations like Bord na Mona, which to some extent is being repurposed away, you know, and supposedly keeping its capacities. But really, I think we've seen that a lot of these large state-owned industries have just been run down into the ground and they haven't been replaced with anything. And like Ireland, when we never really industrialized in some sense in Ireland, we sort of skipped the industrial level of development and went straight from a largely agrarian economy and very quickly come to this high level service economy. And we don't maybe have that strong base of industrialization and of technical knowledge in the country that allows us to deal with these problems. And certainly that the state doesn't have it. And having gone through a brief developmentalist period of developing, that capacity now seems to have allowed it to decline. Which is really harming our ability to try to think our way out of this situation.
I think you're being very kind to the ruling class there, because first of all, you know, things have changed in the last 30 years. Yeah, like it's neoliberalism has happened in the last 30 years. That's the process that has been happening, as well as an additional process of suburbanization that is attendant to that, where the entire planning system, everything is geared towards creating markets as opposed to public good. But like in terms of the ruling class in Ireland and national bourgeoisie that they have, we have, you know, it's not that they're not confident in themselves or that they lack the expertise. They are highly confident in themselves to the point of hubris. And the thing that they are transitioning Ireland into, and they're using the energy system, they're using the agricultural system to do it, is that we have done the tax haven model for quite some time now. Things have moved on. That's not quite working so much anymore. And now they are transitioning to a carbon haven model where there is climate laws coming in places like the Netherlands, for example. The Urgenda case happened there. And there was, you know, very set carbon targets placed on the Netherlands government. And as a result, cheese processing has been moved over to Ireland because our carbon law is not so strong as that. And that was something that was done on purpose by the government in order to provide that additional market, you know. And same with energy. Like we are basically using our energy system in a way that is not for public good, but in fact is to allow highly intensive, carbon intensive companies and structures like data centers to exist on a national grid that can't actually take them. But, so, you know, that's a piece of arbitrage that the ruling class is purposefully engaging in.
Well, I mean, I agree with what you're saying there, but I think that perhaps...
I'm just going to bring in Hannah, actually. I wouldn't mind just one thing that always comes to my mind, Hannah, just on that point before Gard comes back, is like what exactly is the breakdown of energy use in Ireland? Like we, I suppose there's always the headline kind of industries, but like what is it that uses most energy? Could you maybe give us a sense of that?
Thanks for throwing me what for me is an easy question rather than the sort of the politics or the economic question.
Feel free to weigh in on the politics as well. We're delighted.
With very with a lot of interest, but I'm not sure if I can add much to that discussion. But for facts and so on, I'm really happy to oblige. So we think for what we call our final energy consumption, we often think about electricity. That's really, really important, and most of our economy is going to electrify as we decarbonize. But actually, about 40% of our energy goes to transport, so to cars and trucks, and another 40% approximately to heat, and that's split between industry and heating buildings like homes and businesses. So we are very fossil fuel dependent. Around 85% of our energy comes from fossil fuels in Ireland, which is still very high by European standards. And so the fossil fuel dependence is really, and we don't, it's not just very high amount of fossil fuels. We also need lots of energy to get around because we're so car dependent, very poor public transport infrastructure. And because of the nature of our housing and our planning, we're so dispersed that we're kind of dependent on cars. And then our houses are built very inefficiently, so they leak loads of heat, and we have to spend a lot of money on fossil fuels. So as a colleague of mine pointed out, we're importing about 1 billion euros worth of fossil fuels every 1 million euros of fossil fuels every hour, so around 8 billion euros a year in fossil fuel imports last year, which is just leaving the economy and just being literally going up into smoke. And the reason for all the inflation and most of the hardship that came since the Russia's invasion of Ukraine was really because we're so fossil fuel dependent, you know, and a lot of people would kind of blame green policies for kind of increasing prices, but it's fossil fuel dependence and like high energy intensity to meet our basic needs that's causing kind of both the energy crisis, hardship, inflation, and also the climate crisis. So there's that, all those kind of interdependent kind of factors. But yeah, you maybe I can talk a little bit more about electricity as well, because you asked where energy comes from. For electricity, like there's sort of a better news story when it comes to I suppose emissions. We're not particularly clean, the electricity grid, but we do have 40% of our electricity, or almost that, comes from onshore wind. And despite the fact that we have challenges with the transmission and distribution system, and Airgrid, our grid operator, is seen as really world leading in integrating that very, very variable renewable energy into a grid that is quite isolated from Europe. So we don't have that capacity to trade loads with Britain, and we'd have no interconnection yet with with the continent, and we don't have this kind of zero carbon or kind of flexible, like we don't have hydropower. I was just in Sweden and they have like loads of hydropower that they can complement renewables. So it is like our electricity grid is very is challenging to operate, and it will be seen as we're leading in integrating those renewables. That being said, it's you know, the fact that we're being this key location for really, really energy intensive data centers is a very big problem for that sort of small flexible grid that's running on a lot of variable renewables. And it's certainly pushing up the amount of natural gas that we have to use. Probably, you know, was one of the reasons why Moneypoint is still coming on, because data centers are now consuming about 1/5 of our electricity, which is really jaw dropping when you think about it. And that's and there's kind of no sign in that abating. You know, while there's some kind of discussion about data centers being there to, you know, export heat to maybe district heating networks, they really haven't built that capacity to sort of export that heat that can be used. And the you know, I think they've justified themselves based on the fact that they often get built with power purchase agreements with renewables. But the goal isn't to build more renewables. The goal is to cut greenhouse gases. And the, you know, the faster that you grow demand, unless you've got a completely decarbonized power system, the fast, you know, it's just basic maths. You're going to increase fossil fuels on the system.
Yeah, and I suppose that's kind of, I suppose, one of the major debates then, maybe within the green movement, to use the word maybe more generously, that is, to what extent do we have to cut demand? To what extent is it possible to cut demand, or do we need to, or is it possible to transition through decarbonizing energy production? And I suppose I know that would be one of the main arguments used for the development of nuclear power, that it is so abundant that perhaps the reduction in demand isn't as necessary to an extent. Do you see any validity in that?
Well, for me, it's all about timing. So I think like the kind of decarbonization of all of our energy system is inevitable. Like we're actually, people kind of underestimate the speed of this energy transition, what we call the energy transition, which is this move away from fossil fuels, as we, you know, electrify heating and transport, and then to decarbonize electricity. There's a very good news story. There's exponential take up of electric vehicles, of wind, of solar globally, and we're going to see all that play out in Ireland. But when it comes to climate change, it's really about the kind of the speed at which you can cut emissions. You know, and Ireland, you know, we've got this sort of idea in our mind that net zero by 2050. But what our analysis is showing, I also, you know, look at carbon budgets and what is a fair amount of cumulative carbon that Ireland can emit into the atmosphere as a fair contribution to the Paris Agreement target. And when you think about that, when you think about the kind of the remaining global carbon budget that can be emitted to keep global warming to safe temperatures, and then you kind of maybe allocate that down on a per capita basis, we've got a tiny amount left, only something about 5 years or 6 years of our current emissions. And then you start to think it's not about what we're doing in 2050 or 2040 even, it's about what we're emitting right now. And then you have to think that changes the narrative about, or the mindset about what measures we have to take to cut emissions. So when it comes to nuclear, you know, like I was recently in Sweden, and it's very interesting, the political really hot topic there that almost like was one of the main topics coming up to the last election was whether they should go for like reignite their nuclear fleet or go more for renewables, go for more wind. I was thinking, wow, what a nice problem to have, because they actually they've already fully decarbonized their electricity system. They've got existing nuclear, but also have a lot of hydro and biomass. And they, like after the oil crisis in the 70s, they got off oil and gas for heating as well. So they have district heating, you know, that, you know, we were talking with them about natural gas, you know, like, isn't that very dangerous to have, you know, these combustible fluids or gases in your home, you know? And it's a very interesting perspective to take. Whereas in Ireland, we kind of doubled down, and we've rebuilt a lot of fossil fuel infrastructure since then. So I suppose just to get onto that thing about nuclear and wind, and I, you know, that they certainly do take ideological positions, but and some countries are increasing their nuclear capacity where they have the institutional ability to do that and so on. In Ireland, I would say that we're world leading in some aspects with onshore wind, and we do have a lot large offshore wind capacity. And I mean, there's going to be a challenge. The kind of next frontier is balancing it when it's not, balancing electricity demand and supply when it's windy and not windy. And those flexibility and storage solutions are being developed. And that's a really interesting space to be in. So you're talking about
Okay.
different forms of batteries, hydrogen, and
Yeah.
so on. And just the question of nuclear is how quickly can you build that? Because we're kind of building wind and solar kind of quickly right now. And if you know, but if nuclear can come on in like by and can't come on by 2040, it's hard to see what kind of big role it would take. And I'm sure Garrett is really itching to come
I
in
know.
and
I'm really
discuss
bringing in Garrett,
this.
but I want to come to Adrian first. Adrian, I was just wondering, Lorna mentioned suburbanization there, and we're hearing, I work in a rural environment where most people live in one-off homes, and there's I suppose we're hearing figures about public transport emissions and that. And I'm just thinking, from the perspective of a former Bord na Mona worker, like a factory worker or whatever, where do these conversations land? How do they land with them? Like renewable energy, nuclear power, the need for higher density living. Does any of this, is there any, I don't know, how does it land with those
Yeah,
workers?
I don't. Yeah, I mean, there's a complete disconnect, and I blame ourselves for this as well. Like in terms of educating our own people, and planning transitions that actually meant something, right? And I don't think we've been very good at that. And I also think that on very in some respects, the debate here can take place at a rhetorical level or at a level of a remove that, fellas going to work and say, what's this got to do with me or what's the end result? And the end result, people look at it and say, geez, I'm paying an awful lot in electricity and energy costs than what I was 2 years ago. That's where the reality hits home with regard to the people that we represent, right? But there's a couple of things that I would say in terms of what we need to do. I think Garrett made a point in terms of say, when you look at the evolution of the ESB or Bord na Mora, there were really good examples of Sinn Féinism, of us doing it ourselves, and building up an expertise of going to Soviet Russia at the time or going to Nazi Germany at the time. In the 30s and in the 40s, learning from them, bringing it home, and Bord na Mona being the leading company in peat excavation, ESB being very, very dynamic in some aspects, and they were, during the 70s, 80s, 90s, doing an awful lot of work abroad, etc. There has been a hollowing out of that technical sort of ability for us to build again, right? And that was done systematically in terms of ensuring the marketization of these various different markets. So the question now is, how do you turn that around, and in who should be leading that? And I think if you were to go down, like the one project that I was involved in was trying to save the last brick at factory, because it's actually an example of modernist building in outside of Bor. It's going nowhere. I'd much prefer to be in a situation, by the way, and saying, well, could you preserve that and build some sort of a green power station now, whether that's nuclear, hydrogen, or whatever. I'd prefer to see, rather than using transition or just transition, is some sort of reindustrialization of the areas that really need it, because the knock-on consequences are quite profound. And I'm saying that, and I remember, where there's bogs, there's poverty. That's nearly the true the world over. And to turn that around, you had very vibrant communities. I often give the example of Offaly, hurling and football being way above of what it should have had with population wise. But people were involved and living locally. The people I have now on board of Mona, their sons now are in the construction division, going up the road to Dublin to build houses, to build office blocks, etc., and aren't involved as much in their local community as their fathers and their mothers were before them. So I think we need to start that semi-state sector, I always thought, was much more dynamic. I've represented people in the public sector, the private sector, the semi-state sector. The semi-state sector was a very dynamic sector. And in some respects, it was able to kind of hit that sweet spot of commercial realities versus a social good. We don't, my experience, and again, I would say we don't have a dynamic public service. We just don't in a lot of areas. Some that I'm not saying totally, but that's my experience of representing. It's not a dynamic space.
Yeah.
And we need to look at ways in which you can have public and socially owned services, but are dynamic. That doesn't mean that they have to be competitive in a neoliberal kind of sense, but they do need to be able to be places where they're creative, they can react to reality. And I'm not sure, we're a long way from that. Bord na Mona used to be a very dynamic space, and was my experience both working in it and representing workers in it.
Yeah, that's great, Adrian. And I think, like, so you mentioned reindustrialization there now twice. I think it's great word to kind of settle on for a moment. I think maybe I'll bring Garrett in and then maybe Lorna as well. Like, for a lot of people, I'd say if you ask the average person on the street, you know, the idea of industry and industrialization and environmentalism, they're not things that people tend to put together. Quite the opposite in my experience, within the the environmental movement, there's much more of an emphasis on maybe small scale and localized solutions to the climate crisis and also to energy production. So I'm thinking of things, for example, like creating energy at a local level, and I know there's a lot of emphasis on the right to sell that back to the grid and so on. So that's, I suppose, if you were to contrast that kind of industrialization approach to a climate transition with maybe a small scale approach. I'm not sure. I think, you know, nuclear power is probably the prime example of the not small scale approach. Do you want to maybe comment on that? And then maybe Lorna, you can respond also.
Yeah, I mean, Adrian mentioned the Bricka plant as being a great modernist bit of construction. And modernism, I think, is something that we should embrace more when we talk about the climate change. Modernism in the sense, maybe in the old Marxist sense of development, we shouldn't be afraid of industrial development. We should be in favor of more and more rapid industrial development. Well, I'm convinced myself that what we need to do to get us through this climate crisis is not to indulge in any notions that we can retreat into some, you know, pre-industrial age where we didn't have climate change. I mean, you know, we can't support the world population that we have, let alone the quality of life that we have now, in a pre-industrial age. We need to embrace the way forward, which is to actually develop the capacity, the energy capacity, the industrial capacity more generally, to transform our society. And when we talk about transformation, it is a technological and industrial transformation that we need. Even when we talk about, you know, things like biodiversity and restoring biodiversity in our landscapes, that still is what we're talking about, really, is an industrial transformation, because we need a massive transformation in land use. We need a massive transformation in how we farm and grow food so that it's less land intensive, which means really that it becomes more industrial, more scientifically driven. So these things, to my mind, like we have to, there's no way that we're going to get out in any way, come out of this climate crisis without re-engaging with what is in some ways an old school kind of Marxist Promethean tradition of actually saying that we're going to transform the world through technology, and we're actually going to see technology as what drives the social change that we're going to need. I think that it's something that those of us who are here as socialists should really be embracing and should be talking about more. I mean, specifically with regard to, also I just want to go back to what Hannah was mentioning a minute ago when we were talking about energy, you know, that the approach to sort of transforming the energy system or to developing, trying to develop a low carbon energy system in Ireland has sort of relied on a combination of, I think, somewhat anti-industrial, maybe traditional, I would call slightly hippie-ish environmentalism, which kind of talks about localism and we'll have small local efforts here and I'll have a solar panel on my roof and I'll grow my vegetables in my back garden and we might have a windmill up the road belonging to the village. These things are all fine in their own right, but I don't think that they have the capacity to really amount to this transformative change that we need. It is something that will have to come from a real concentrated, and I think essentially will have to be a state-led industrial development that is really aimed at massively changing how we generate electricity, but also how we build and produce almost everything in our societies. Now we can indulge a little bit in kind of fantasy thinking, you know, there's also, it was mentioned already, I think, during the conversation that when we talk about climate, we can easily start playing sort of accounting tricks, you know, about, we can talk about whether, well, I've lowered my carbon emissions because I installed the solar panel, but, you know, the solar panel was built in China and the emissions go onto their balance sheet and not onto mine. We can talk a lot about, are we adding lots of renewable energy capacity, but avoid talking about the question of whether we're reducing carbon emissions, which is what really matters. So I think we need to have a way of thinking about this transformation, which is, I think, by necessity will have to be more centralized. We will have to be very serious and not be playing counting tricks, not be playing, you know, this neoliberal game of shuffling the books around, but actually talking about our real carbon emissions, talking about how we really generate everything, how everything that we use in our society is actually produced, and embracing the industrialization that's needed to transform all that production. I've forgotten what I was, the other thing I was going to say was, so that might be a good time to stop on that note.
Lorna, do you want to come in on that, I suppose? Yeah, I'm not actually, I'd be really interested to hear in terms of Raritha, Party for Workers and Carers, would there be a spread of opinion in terms of industry and community or?
Well, I suppose there's several programme documents that we have that actually outline our thinking. So if you ever want some bedtime reading, most of them run to about 30 pages. But I suppose speaking of 30 pages, like I actually did read the policy document that was produced by yourselves, so the Let's Get Real document. And you know, I think that we're possibly not going to agree with each other on that, because I suppose I have gone carefully through that document, and you know, we have a different approach to the idea of industrialization or the idea of development of the Irish state. And I suppose where that comes from is that we had our initial program, and our initial program document actually went through the transformation that has happened in the last 30 years in land use, in financialization, you know, in terms of urbanization, or you know, deep suburbanization that has been happening in the Irish state. And you know, I know that Hannah wasn't talking about suburbanization as a political process, but I can tell you as a councillor, I'm sure Eilish can as well, it's a deeply political process. And that is a political decision. Suburbanization is a political decision that has been made over the last three decades. That is the thing that has actually created car dependency. That is the thing that has created housing where every single house has an oil tank behind it, which in any other European country would be seen as just totally crazy, you know, something that's just totally beyond and out of the way. And, you know, district heating comes up in conversations all the time about, you know, less you know, things like data centres. Oh, but we can have district heating. Unfortunately, the planning and settlement patterns of the Irish state means that district heating is a bit of a pipe dream as well, because there isn't the density to actually make that necessarily efficient, except outside of Dublin, maybe.
Put a nuclear plant in Poolbeg, we can have district heating. I have made myself very popular with several people by suggesting it.
Well, you see, this is where I suppose we're getting into the point of where we may be disagreeing with each other, and I think it's because we would see a different order of steps that are required to be taken. So Hannah has said, you know, I would tend to agree that, you know, in terms of hitting 2030 targets, you know, nuclear plants are not going to be produced by the Irish state in that time, if indeed they are produced by the Irish state, because the Irish state's current political economy is basically one that will open up markets for private actors to come in. And even if those private actors happen to be state actors from other states, they have no reason whatsoever to actually do things for the public good in Ireland. But, you know, the worst case scenario, which is probably the most likely case scenario in terms of the Irish state attempting to build a nuclear plant right now, is that it would probably be, you know, tendered out to Dennis O'Brien, will be constructed at a mica, you know, because that's most large infrastructure projects in the current capitalistic Irish state tend to go. But for us, the thing that actually needs to happen is that the political economy is required to change. And like, in terms of like the step change between now and maybe somewhere down the line, where once we've kind of gotten as many renewables as possible, we're still finding that we're having issues with filling the stock gap for those types of variable energy. I mean, like, you know, we already have a system of interconnectors that are going in at the moment, and like Moneypoint and Poolbeg between them in your document produce 1,300 megawatts, but the East-West interconnector and the Celtic connector at the moment is 1,200 megawatts, and there's more development happening with interconnectors between Ireland and France. So, you know, at the end of the day, in terms of like the claims that are made about the cheapness of nuclear energy, you know, like, there's already a country right beside us that has nuclear plants. Hinkley is something that seems to have been constructed as an export kind of power generator. But even so, they're still like basically paying around 30 pence for the kilowatt hour, which is kind of similar to what we are paying here anyway. So, you know, maybe the interconnector between France and Ireland might make that difference, and that is already in development, and that is something that will kind of change things. But I suppose, without even going into the technical points, there is still an issue where we are not currently in a state that has the public good as its primary political concern. And this goes back to something that Adrian has said, which is, you know, people going into work in the morning, people working in the energy sector, you know, how can we actually speak to these people, all of us here on a highfalutin left-wing kind of podcast? How do we actually speak to the workers? Well, of course, we're politicians, so we go and speak to them on the door. And I have spoken to several energy workers on the doors as I've been going around the place. And always the answer we come up with on the left is, perhaps it's about educating people. Perhaps it's about riling people up and making them angry and getting them to act in that way. And how, you know, we do ask ourselves questions like, how can we actually have a dynamic space? The fact of the matter is that the thing that workers actually require in their jobs is agency. What they require for us to actually move to a better developed energy system than the one that we have at the moment is for the workers as experts to have the agency to develop the plan for that. So in terms of like decarbonizing the system, it's not going to be fixed by nuclear per se, and also like the process of industrialization in Ireland, because I saw in your document that the idea actually is to be generating much more energy than we currently are generating. And the hope, I suppose, would be that that additional energy would result in a process of industrialization. But that's a little bit like putting the cart before the horse. And I suppose, to maybe be complimentary about the document, I am being complimentary, but to be complimentary about it, there is something about reading that document that read to me like it was almost written by somebody who works in the nuclear industry, and I know that statistics is your end of things, so that's the level of expertise that you have brought into it, but there's something about it that is kind of puts the technology first as opposed to the political economy first. And if we want to actually utilize a technology, for me, the political economy has to be actually one where workers already have agency, they're organized. Oh, and another thing, Adrian, yes, the Bordenmono workers went to Germany, they also went to Soviet Russia at that time as well.
No, he
Um,
mentioned, in
so
fairness, Adrian actually mentioned Soviet Russia first.
He put
Yeah,
Soviet Russia first.
yeah. I actually didn't realize either of those things. Hey guys, you want to come in for a couple of minutes there, and then I might just put a question to each of the panelists to wrap things up, maybe.
I suppose just to respond to the last point that Lorna made first, talking about putting the energy technology before the political economy. I mean, I am an old school set of Marxist Promethean, and I do think that the technological change makes the social change possible. I think that having an abundant energy source available, having a system that can provide abundant energy, is a necessary step. I don't think that we will get there by doing it the other way around. But I also want to come back to some things that you said and that Hannah said on the sort of more technical points. I know we didn't want this to be just about nuclear energy, but we're having a round about nuclear energy now, so we might as well.
No, that's
We
giving me
might as
what I
well
want,
have it. You're giving me what I want anyway.
As long as I get the last word, then that's fine.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, who am I going to give the last word to,
I have a lot of, and I am, you said I sound like whoever wrote that document worked in the nuclear energy. It was mainly my me, and I absolutely don't work in the nuclear industry, but I am a convert, right? I'm very much converted to the cause. And one of the strange things that happens when you have conversations, or the frustrating things when we have conversations about nuclear, is first of all, there's always a question that says, well, it takes too long, you should have built it years ago. And then people at the same time say, well, now isn't the time to do it, we should do it in the future. And of course, this argument can be made forever to always postpone putting off beginning this process of developing a technology, which to me is, and this is more just about the technology than about the politics, but I think is a technology that's hugely important, but I do think is probably the only technology that is really going to get us out of this energy crisis that we're in the next 30 decades. So, I mean, Hannah talked about, and you've mentioned a little bit, Lauren, as well, about and the big process that's made in adding renewables. And then, there's always this caveat, which is, and of course, we have this problem of what do we do when we add so many renewables if the system becomes unreliable. But this problem is a huge problem. It is still an unsolved problem. There are technologies being developed, but there is nothing in development, in an advanced state of development, that could be deployed in Ireland now, or to my knowledge, in the near future, that could actually allow us to create a zero carbon energy grid apart from nuclear power. I'm not aware of anything that would make that possible. And I know not a lot of people sincerely believe in producing a renewables only zero carbon grid. I've never seen a plan that actually says what is the technology that fills the gaps. Interconnectors, yes, we can have a lot of interconnectors. We have very small interconnector capacity now. We have a very small planned interconnector capacity for the near future. There's no plan for it to be anywhere near enough to actually meet our demand. At the moment in Ireland, on a winter's night like tonight, the peak energy demand in Ireland could reach 7 gigawatts. The total interconnector capacity we have is 1 gigawatt. And we could well have a situation where you have a cold night with no wind and you need 7 gigawatts of energy. And that is before we electrify our home heating and we electrify our transport, which, as Hannah's already mentioned, are two-thirds of our energy use. So we need to massively increase the energy supply. I want to massively increase the energy supply so that we can also reindustrialize, or perhaps industrialize for the first time in Ireland, and contribute to this industrial transformation that's needed. But just to meet our current energy demands for transport and heating, we will need a massive increase in energy supply. So we can often get, as I said, caught up on what I earlier mentioned as these kind of referred to as accounting tricks, or we can look at the good number. The good number is we're adding nuclear or renewable capacity all the time. The bad number is our carbon emissions are still going up. A few years ago, 2018, 2019, or whatever year it was, Ireland committed to the carbon budget, which says we should reduce carbon emissions by 5% a year for 5 years and then by 10% a year for the next 5 years. And in the next 2 years, they went up by 5%. And renewable capacity is being added, it's being added, it's being added, but the carbon emissions go up. So we have this huge disconnect between the progress that we are making, and there is progress being made in some areas of the renewable technology, and the huge glaring hole where we know that there is a problem that is not currently solved, and that I don't think that there's any immediate prospect of it being solved. And there is a technology that could solve it. Yes, it won't happen straight away. It will take a lot of work. It will take a long time to come online, but it needs to start now. I mean, I hate to be a pessimist, but people say, well, we won't get nuclear up and online in time to make a big dent in our emissions by 2040. I don't think anything else will either. I don't think that not building nuclear is going to see us get our carbon emissions under control by 2040. I'm sure Hannah, I think, probably thinks otherwise. And I was willing to hear about these other things, but I haven't seen the evidence for what those solution or other solutions are. And when we say that building nuclear would require a huge technical capacity the state doesn't have, that is very, I think, is very well true. And as we started out talking about the lack of technical capacity in the state is a huge problem. But without nuclear, we need technology that doesn't currently exist. And if we want it to be used for the public good, it needs to be built and controlled by the state as well. So we need the state to, one way or another, we need an Irish state that can build, control, and run for the public good a massively complex energy system. One way might involve using nuclear power, which we don't currently have the ability to build, but we know how it's done. And the other way might involve technology that doesn't exist yet, and we don't even know how to build it. So to my mind, nuclear is the only way forward for that reason. And I think it fits entirely as well with what we've talked about, which is the fact that we have this lack of technical capacity in the state, which has been deliberately, what technical capacity there was there has been deliberately run down. And we have a ruling class in the state, which is essentially comes from, is interested in finance, is interested in, as you said, the status of the state as a tax haven, is interested in financialization, has no real connection to the industrial economy, what little industrial economy there is in Ireland, has no idea really about production, about the energy system globally, exists detached from it. And so we can have this situation where the state can sleepwalk itself into creating, having a collapsing energy grid, and at the same time promoting Ireland as a place to bring your data centers to avoid carbon taxes elsewhere. Because the state, we have a state that can focus on the financial benefits of being a carbon haven, as Lorna said earlier, and yet be completely unaware or incapable of engaging with the actual problems of electricity provision or
Well,
any kind of energy provision.
those are political choices. The state makes political choices, but I'll leave it at that.
So maybe just to recap on the, I think it sounds like we're at the workers and carers, party of workers and carers have a number of policy documents, as does the Workers' Party in relation to this. Adrian has the book. Adrian, what's the title of that book that
It's simply called Trade Unions. It's part of the Cork University Press series called Shiroct.
Fantastic. And I suppose, Hannah, there's both that the EPA report which you mentioned earlier, and am I right, a weekly column in the Irish Times?
Monthly. I don't have a weekly column in me, but.
The monthly column in the Irish Times. So I suppose there are some things that anybody listening can have a look to for further ideas about people's views on these issues. And I might, I suppose, hand over to Hannah and then Adrian to respond to what you've heard. I'd particularly, I suppose, be interested in if there was like one change you'd like to see the Irish state make in to step in the right direction, what that might be.
That, thanks. So there's a lot in that, and I was just furiously writing notes. But I suppose I would start with the many things that we would agree on, and I'm sure like all of us would agree that the energy transition and the transformation, you know, has to be state led. That it has to, you know, the state requires a lot of technical capacity and institutional capacity to do that, and can't outsource it to consultants or that there's big problems with that. So we need the kind of technical capacity to do the transformation, that we have to be forward looking rather than backwards looking, and that, like, inherently, you know, new energy technologies are absolutely necessary, as well as, I'd say, like, to extend that into the agriculture sector, which is very important. And I suppose that electrification would be the backbone of the energy transition, because electricity is inherently the cleanest and most efficient form of energy. And I would say that even though, like, in our we model scenarios on the energy transition, while there'll be a big increase in electricity, overall energy use will probably decline, because electricity is so much more efficient. So as we electrify cars and heating, and as we kind of make our transport systems and buildings more efficient, overall actual energy use will decline, but it still requires a big transformation in how we produce electricity. So that, I suppose, the main question then is whether nuclear energy is the way to go. And I suppose technically, just from you know, and Gareth, you're an expert in statistics far more than I am, and you had that whole fallacy that, you know, renewables have gone up, but so have our emissions. But you have to, you know, rather than looking at the correlation between those things, you have to look at them. Real causation and the system, and emissions on average have stabilized. So right now we're back to where we were in 1990 after a peak around 2008. So emissions have been falling, and certainly not fast enough. But the power sector is the sector where emissions have fallen the most significant. That's because of the successful rollout of wind energy, and even right now, if we kept the kind of the share of renewables in our electricity system steady and simply electrified heating and transport, we would see a big fall in emissions, just because of that nature, that kind of efficient nature of electricity. And, you know, you pointed to this kind of narrative about renewables, the small scale renewables, the little solar panel or the community owned wind turbine. You know, I think that maybe was the vision of renewables in the 70s or 80s. When nuclear was this big, you know, really industrial kind of, you know, it was really the monolith of low carbon power. But we're undergoing renewable energy kind of industrialization. You know, like you talked about solar panels made in China. China is churning out solar panels, and it is the fastest growing source of energy. It is, you know, you can have, you know, so some people would say you can have a nuclear reactor on your roof because you're using the fusion reactor of the sun, and a house that is modern, that is well insulated, that has a decent solar array on its roof, and that has an electric car, can be energy positive for a lot of the year, can actually be exporting energy to the grid. So while you can use the example of, like, a cold, windless winter evening as being the kind of worst case, you know, for a lot of the year, we can have our energy system entirely powered on renewables, which is fantastic. And you're right that we're not there yet completely with kind of solving that worst case scenario. But those solutions I would believe that they're coming, and that would be including things like district heating. I think there is a role for that. Not, of course, not for one off detached houses, but like any housing estate effectively could have district heating that would kind of match up heat demand from wind and be able to store that heat over long periods, with hydrogen, with interconnection, with demand flexibility. We're going to have a lot of batteries in our electric cars. It'll be a whole smorgasbord of solutions rather than one thing. So that's just my response to Gareth. So hopefully that wasn't too long. And that effectively the renewables transition is coming, and it's happening, and that's really good news, and it's really about the speed that we can do that. If I could ask the government for one thing, it would just simply be giving the right to every school child the ability to get to school without a car, whether that's through electric school bus or footpaths and cycle lanes. I think it's such a simple problem to solve. It would bring about so many good things. And for some reason, primary schools, secondary schools don't even have footpaths getting to them. And that causes so much That causes such an unpleasant, unhealthy, you know, car dependent, fossil fuel dependent environment. So that would be that's my one wish list. Thanks a lot. Over to you,
thanks,
Adrian.
Thanks, Hannah. I just wonder, Adrian, do you want to come in and have a last word on?
I think just very quickly, and I'd agree with Hannah in relation to that. As a kind of keen cyclist myself and around Cork, it's just really unpleasant going a lot of places, you know. And the older you get, the less confident you are, I think, as well, on a bike, you know. But anyway, that's by the by. I'd have to say I really enjoyed Gareth's policy paper. I'm not an expert on the, you know, on the technology here, but I love the grand scale of thinking about it. And he had me on a panel before, and I said there used to be kind of three kind of parts of the creed on the left when you were growing up. You were pro-Palestine, you were again the church, and you were again nuclear energy, you know. And that was just, and I think he kind of got that reaction in his own party until, you know, kind of challenging people in terms of, well, why are you again it, as it were, you know. And I had a similar sort of Saulian transition myself, in which I'd be very open to it. But I think what annoys me most is that the state, you know, is so much richer than what we were in the 20s or the 30s. We built the biggest public works project in the 1920s, and we were impoverished. And we generated our entire electricity demand by that one project for a short period of time. We don't have that sense of nation building, of kind of, you know, renewing your baptismal vows. It'll be great to see that kind of sense of, yes, we can, is Fader Ling. And I do think we have, you know, that the planning laws are completely turned on head in terms of the position of the individual over that of the public good. So I do think we need a banker probably on top of, and a default energy supply on top of renewables, it would strike me, if we don't have hydroelectric capacity. But it's that sense of determination, whether you call it Promethean or not, I'm not sure, but that I'd like to see. And we sadly lack that.
I wonder if you wanted to say, if you had just one quick word on what you think is the most important. What is the role for the unions, or what is the most important thing that the unions should be fighting for in regards to energy?
You know, I would make the point in saying that I think an important part of our job has always been to spread economic sovereignty, okay? And I like that sense of word in terms of, well, how do you do that and how do you empower people? And in energy, it strikes me really in teasing that through, it has to be large publicly owned creators and of energy is probably the best way to do that.
Thanks, Adrian. Thanks, Elaine. Laura, do you want to have a last word before?
Okay. We've had several last words. Yeah. Everyone's had a last word. I just think that it's not technology, you know, it's just these things can't be solved by technology. It's actually the political system needs to change, and it comes down at the end of the day to workers, because there's no point having a nuclear power plant that doesn't have a transmission system to get it to people's houses. And even if we had the best technology in the world and it was still privately owned, that would be a massive problem. So it is about empowering workers and carers, and nothing happens without them. And that for me still is the starting point of where where you go from where we are to something that is better than what we currently have, you know.
Well, I think if we can, and maybe it wraps up with what Adrian was saying as well to finish, is that my view about, and we can argue, like, nuclear technology is technology, but what I really want to argue for is that when we're talking about climate change and transformation, when we're talking to workers, we're presenting a vision which is not a vision of austerity, not a vision of having to retreat into some sort of poverty or of having to be ashamed of yourself for having achieved a decent standard of living. It's of talking to workers and saying, we have a vision that's going to offer you, as Adrian said, economic sovereignty, security in your energy, control over the fundamentals of the economy, and the energy system is fundamental to any economy. And as part of that, we have to be able to offer some vision of an energy system and of a climate transformation that can actually empower that, that can allow that. And what's so part of what's so appealing to me, apart from the fact that I studied physics and I'm a nerd and I love nuclear energy, part of what's so empowering or so exciting about it to me is that it does offer people this vision to say, we can build this system. Yes, technology won't change society, but we can build this sort of system which makes it possible to change society. And we can build support for that among the working class by saying to people, we're not just going out here. And I am a committed environmentalist, and I know you are, and we all are here, I think. We can go out to people and say, we are not just offering you a vision of misery, a vision of guilt. We're not just coming out to here to tell you all the things you're doing wrong. We're coming out to here to tell you how we can make a better world. And I think as a socialist, you have to be talking to people about making a better world. To my mind, the technological transformation and the social transformation, they have to go together. I hate to bring in the D word, but there's a dialectical relationship there, you know, that you can't completely separate them. But we have to be able to find a way to talk to people about climate that isn't immediately just switching people off. It isn't just telling them you have to do less. You have to feel bad about what you're doing. You have to, you know, look forward to a future of poverty. We can say to people, no, we have a better way forward that we can offer. That's at least how I would like to see things.
Okay, and that's where we'll finish things for today, possibly with even more questions than answers. Please subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and do share it with your friends, and have a look at our previous episodes. Many thanks to all of our guests, and we look forward to speaking with you again soon.